Relentless bombing continues in Gaza as Israel tries to root out Hamas. While the civilian death toll increases, foreign nationals stuck in Gaza, including some Americans, are allowed to cross the border into safety.
We would like to get all the hostages back. But I don't know if there is a real deal on the table.
Diplomats discuss a pause in the action in attempts to free more hostages held by Hamas.
Classical Christian education trains citizens who can think for themselves and who are good, virtuous citizens.
Educating the whole child. We take a look at a teaching philosophy gaining momentum in Catholic education. And a trip inside one of the world's oldest monasteries, the famed Heiligenkreuz Abbey in Austria. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
We have no idea what's happened to him. We don't know if he's alive or dead or injured.
Israelis begin the mourning for soldiers whose lives have already been taken during the first weeks of war, as loved ones of hostages held by Hamas await their fate.
They're receiving mass casualties, scores of mass casualties, all day and night.
And a pediatrician pleads for an end to the destruction taking the lives of innocent children in Gaza. This war would not have begun if Hamas terrorists had not crossed the border into Israel on October 7th and attacked and murdered more than 1,000 Israeli citizens. But Israel's retaliation, the optics of death and suffering from the Gaza bombardment, have caused increasing public pressure. Governments in Middle East countries that have normalized relations with Israel are feeling the heat, and critics here in the United States are becoming increasingly vocal. But there was a positive development this week when some people trapped since the war began were given safe passage out of Gaza.
So we got there at little before 7, and 12 hours later, it was a long process, but it was a process that moved slowly. We were out on the Egyptian side.
Finally, the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt was opened this week. Hundreds of foreign nationals were allowed to leave, along with dozens of seriously injured Palestinians taken to Egypt for urgent medical care. One of the first Americans out, Dr. Barbara Zind, a pediatrician from Colorado who had been in Gaza as a volunteer visiting physician. She called herself fortunate because she was able to shelter with other international workers in special United Nations facilities, something regular Gazan citizens could not. From her hotel room in Cairo, Egypt, she describes what it was like to be trapped inside Gaza.
It's been scary. In the last 2 weeks, there we kept running out of water, and that was water to flush the toilet. We always were fortunate to have drinking water, which was not true of the Gazans that were just outside the fence from us. They were running out of drinking water. But we ran out of water for washing and sanitation. We were having more and more cases of diarrhea show up in our community of 50. So I can't imagine what it was like outside the camp, outside in the general camp area.
Regular Gazans remain trapped in the Palestinian territory, where airstrikes have destroyed whole neighborhoods. Massive bombing this week left catastrophic damage in the densely populated Jabala refugee camp in northern Gaza. Israel Defense Forces say the strike targeted a Hamas command and control complex and killed a key Hamas leader, and that the scale of the destruction was caused by the collapse of a spider's web of Hamas tunnels. But scenes like this and the rising death toll continue to cause global outcry for a humanitarian truce. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken departed for yet another trip to the region.
Israel has not only the right but the obligation to defend itself and also to take steps to try to make sure that this never happens again. We've also said very clearly and repeatedly that how Israel does this matters. We will focus as well on steps that need to be taken to protect civilians who are in a crossfire of Hamas's making. And we want to look at concrete steps that can be taken to better protect them.
The death toll has passed a reported 9,000 people in numbers drawn from the Hamas-controlled Ministry of Health. With nowhere to go, hospitals have become refugee centers for the newly homeless. Thousands are sheltering there.
What did these kids do to come and be here? What is their guilt? Where are children's rights? Where are human rights? I brought my kids to sleep here. I used to be afraid of my kids playing in the sand. Now their hands are dirty with the blood on the floor.
Doctors in the hospital say the humanitarian crisis has become horrific as they run out of medicine, anesthetics for surgery, fuel, and power. They are overwhelmed with patients with catastrophic injuries and have run out of options.
Even the patient is improved a little bit, you cannot send him home. Because there is no home, he just staying at the hospital, he feels more safe with his family, because they lost their home and they cannot go anywhere. We have a bad now respiratory illnesses, diarrheal illnesses. We have a bad epidemics inside the hospital. Even the medical team get exhausted.
A pediatrician with the humanitarian medical group Doctors Without Borders, who herself has relatives in Gaza, describes what the doctors are going through.
They sit at work, working 24/7. To care for patients while their families are being bombarded, while they're worrying about being bombarded themselves, and they refuse to leave because they have decided to stay with their patients.
The horror continues for both sides of this war. Relatives of hostages are in anguish, waiting for any word about their loved ones held by Hamas. Behind the scenes, diplomatic negotiations are ongoing to broker their release. But reporter Mark Irons says relatives remain frightened of what could lie ahead.
19-year-old Ronnie Eshel, an Israeli soldier stationed near the border with Gaza, received a worried text message from her mother on October 7th when Hamas terrorists were attacking southern Israel. Ronnie responding to her mother, "I'm okay, Mom. Don't worry about me. I love you too." And that's the last her family heard from Ronnie. Others at her military base were murdered during the Hamas attack, but she is listed as missing.
It's been, atrocious. It's very difficult. It's a sheer agony.
We spoke with her uncle, Elad Levy, who says the family is optimistic she's still alive, but that would also mean she could be held hostage by Hamas.
She's just going to keep calm. I think, she's going to be calm and very focused on her survival and being strong.
Ronnie could be just one of around 240 hostages taken by Hamas from Israel into Gaza. So far, only a handful have been released. In addition, Israel says it rescued another hostage this week. But for most families, grueling uncertainty remains.
Because I want to spread this picture all over to find any idea what's happened to him. We have no clue.
Avraham Lulu Shemriz believes his son could be one of the hostages. Elan, a 26-year-old civilian student in computer engineering, was living on his own when Hamas wreaked havoc on the community where he lived.
Somehow he was pulled out from his house and kidnapped to Gaza.
With the Israeli military advancing further into Gaza, Lulu Shamriz hopes securing hostages' release will be the top priority.
First, release all the hostages.
Without any clear indication of where they are, he's concerned the hostages could be caught in the crosshairs as fighting between Israel and Hamas rages on. In a video this week, Hamas militants claimed they would soon release some non-Israeli hostages without providing further details. They also released a video showing three of the hostages. Meanwhile, as of last week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said 10 Americans are still unaccounted for, and he believes some of them could be held hostage in Gaza. According to a New York Times report citing a Pentagon official, U.S. Special Forces are on the ground in Israel trying to locate hostages. Hoping to reunite with his niece, Elad Levy hopes diplomatic pressure around the world will increase.
That we demand, we ask, we hope, we from the international community, not just the U.S., everybody who has, I'd say, a bit of a basic values of humanity to pressure and demand the release of all the hostages immediately.
And Avraham Lulu Shamriz says he and his wife are praying to God for their son's release.
It's very, very, very hard for us that he's not with us.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
Public reaction to the war has spilled over onto college campuses in the U.S., where protests have erupted into anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, harassment, and even violence. In many cases, peaceful candlelight vigils early in the war have blown up into ugly confrontations. Many Jewish students have expressed fear as anti-Semitic incidents have particularly spiked. On Friday, Cornell University in New York State canceled classes following the arrest of a student believed responsible for making violent anti-Semitic threats online. The 21-year-old student is charged with threatening to slit the throats of Jewish people, specifically targeting those who eat at a kosher dining room on campus. Cornell's Community Day is being used as a day of pause and reflection. The university is just one of many around the country dealing with heightened tensions. The rise of anti-Semitism and global protests against Israel because of the bombardment of Gaza have shaken Jews around the world. The level of deep-seated hatred based on religion has been both shocking and terrifying for many. Here to discuss a situation that feels like it's spiraling out of control are Mary Eberstadt, Senior Research Fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute, and Father Benedict Keeley, founder of Nazarene.org, which advocates for persecuted Christians around the world, with a particular focus on the Middle East. Welcome both of you to this discussion. Father Benedict, this week, both Hamas and Hezbollah extremists said that they will not back down and are threatening continued violence against Israel. Let's listen to a Hamas senior leader speaking on Lebanese television.
We must teach Israel a lesson, and we will do this again and again. The Al-Aqsa flood is just the first time, and there will be a second, a third, a fourth. Because we have the determination, the resolve, and the capabilities to fight. Will we have to pay a price? Yes, and we are ready to pay it. We are called a nation of martyrs, and we are proud to sacrifice martyrs.
Many of Israel's friends and enemies are calling for a humanitarian pause or ceasefire to address the situation in Gaza. But is that enough in the face of this Hamas call for more attacks?
No, quite simply, Monsen, thank you for having me. We're dealing with, we use the term existential crisis quite often, but this truly is an existential crisis for the state of Israel. Hamas is committed to the destruction of the state of Israel. That sounds rather simple on paper. That means the destruction of the Jewish people who live in Israel. They will do to every Jew in Israel what they did to the 1,000 plus 1,400 people that they murdered just a few weeks ago, babies, women, children. It's a terrible thing that innocent people have to suffer, but Israel is fighting for its very existence against an evil, and I use that word quite deliberately, an evil foe who will also, by the way, for our audience, once they destroy the Jews, will turn on the Christians. When they, the old saying is, when the Saturday people are dealt with, the Sunday people will be dealt with. That's us. So this is an existential fight for the state of Israel and for the people of Israel.
Well, things don't seem to be getting any better. Mary, we are seeing frightening scenes of anti-Semitism, not just in the Middle East, but around the world. From last weekend, this video from an airport in Western Russia, just north of Iran. Hundreds of rioters stormed into the airport and then onto the tarmac following the arrival of an international flight from Tel Aviv. Reports indicate that they were chanting anti-Semitic slogans and trying to hunt down Jewish passengers. This is an area of Russia that is predominantly Muslim. The Jewish passengers had to shelter in an airport lounge before they were able to leave safely, and several protesters were arrested. Now, how should we, as Christians, as Catholics, be thinking about these acts of hatred?
Well, we need to understand first, Mansi, that there must be no moral equivalence here, any more than there was in World War II about what the Nazis did. Someone said of World War II, the Nazis ripped the lid off hell. That is what Hamas has done. It has ripped the lid off hell. And with it has come an outpouring of public anti-Semitism, the likes of which we have not seen since the 1940s. And we're seeing them in the United States as well. We have to be very clear about this. What happened on October 7th wasn't just some conflict between, on the one hand, this, on the other hand, that. Families, babies were murdered in their sleep.
This was not a kind of killing that fell from the sky. These murders were committed often inches away from the victims. And there was a revelry in the blood and the gore that I think has shocked the entire civilized world. That's what we're looking at when we look at things like the footage you just showed.
It's shocking. Father Benedict, the U.S. and our allies are worried this conflict will grow into what could become a worldwide conflagration. What should inform the Catholic view about this region of the world, the Holy Land, the Middle East?
Well, we believe that much of the Middle East is holy. We think specifically of Israel when we talk of the Holy Land. But if you think, for example, Syria and Lebanon, these places are places where the Lord himself walked. Egypt, of course, he went as a baby when Joseph and Mary had to flee persecution. So much of the Middle East is holy. It's a place where the Lord walked and his disciples spread the gospel. So it's very important to us as Catholics. We need to have an interest, not just in this current conflict, but also, as we know, in terms of the persecution of our Christian brethren who've been there from the beginning. So we can't avoid it. I would encourage people, and it's not a weak statement, I'd encourage people to pray. We've been called by the Holy Father and various others to pray. This should be serious and urgent prayer. God answers prayer, and it's not a last resort, it's a first resort. So I'd encourage every Catholic to be praying every day for peace.
Absolutely. Well, Mary, the protests around the globe have sparked controversy, representing more than the plight of Palestinians, however, but also involving abortion and LGBTQ activists. What do you think is the root cause of this intersectionality between the two plights?
Well, Mansi, I think the root cause is repaganization. As organized Christianity declines in important parts of the West, we are seeing a return to pagan mores. That is the only thing that unites these otherwise disparate groups that would otherwise be at each other's throats. They have no code of ethics, unlike Christianity, which, although its record in World War II and the Holocaust was mixed, it was never the case that Christianity taught the kind of revelry in bloodshed or taught that it was good to kill the Jews. So with the receding of belief in scripture, we are seeing what happens without it. What happens without it is that people who believe in nothing at all except for the rule of the stronger are surging, again, not only in places where we might expect it, but on American campuses. This is a civilizational step back.
A huge step back. And Father Benedict, then, do these values that Mary just discussed affect the people in the Middle East on the ground in the same way? With our Western eyes, are we actually understanding what the situation really is there and what's actually happening?
Well, we see the over the years what's happened to Christians as well, not just Jews now, but to Christians in the Middle East. And many of them, I have to say, have felt that the West has forgotten them. I've heard this a number of times in Iraq and in Syria from our brethren, that they felt that we hear nice things once in a while, but the West has forgotten them. And I think that's unfortunately true, that we tend to think it's such an awful crisis, there's nothing we can do about it, it's been 2,000 years. But there's a great deal we can do, and I think our Jewish brethren are appreciating very much at the moment the good Christians like our. We were all together in Steubenville, Ohio, just a week ago, releasing this statement on Catholics against anti-Semitism. I think our Jewish brethren are very grateful to us, and we should rightly do it, but they're very grateful that we're showing support. And this is part, again, of the church's mission to be standing with those who are suffering for their religion, suffering for their nationality.
And the casualties there on both sides that are significant. Well, Mary, the relationship between Catholic Christians and Jews is often cited as the reason we show such support for the Jewish community. Can you explain it plainly for us?
Christianity would not exist without Judaism. That's point one. Point two, again, during the Holocaust and in other moments of history, some Christians disgraced themselves with their behavior toward the Jewish people. Some Christians were outstanding counterexamples. If you go to Yad Vashem in Israel, the Holocaust Memorial Museum, you will see over 27,000 people honored for having saved Jewish people in World War II, and most of those people were Christian. So that is the example we should look for, Mansi. What we are hoping for, those of us who were at the conference in Steubenville last week, is to forge an alliance between Catholics and Jews, the likes of which has not existed before, so that we follow the catechism that tells us we can go to hell if we hate our neighbor, so that we embrace our Jewish friends and even those Jews we don't know and stand in solidarity, especially at this critical moment.
And Mary, really quick, just because we're running out of time, for those who are worried about the casualties in Gaza and worried about the plight of the Palestinians, what can you tell them about how we should be praying for them?
We should pray for the victims that of Hamas's violence, wherever they may be. And the people suffering now in Gaza are victims of Hamas. Hamas started this, Father Ben said, existential conflict. I see it as a civilizational conflict. And there's no question about who is in the right here.
Well, I'm grateful for that. And we're grateful for both of you who are watching this continuing crisis. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mansi.
Thank you, Mansi.
There's much more ahead on EWTN News In Depth. Stay right there.
Parents caring deeply is such a good thing. Let's leverage that so that students can benefit from that the most.
Teaching our children to their fullest potential. A look at educational alternatives to traditional schooling that are bringing results. And the Hispanic version of All Souls Day will tell you why the Day of the Dead is a day to celebrate. We'll be right back.
Look upon education not as dropping information into kids' heads, but the opportunity to form human beings for the future on all different levels. The intellectual level, certainly, but the aesthetic level, the social level, the moral level.
The search to find the best way to educate our children. It's a never-ending conversation, sparking debate, emotions, and a desire to do right for future generations. Welcome back to EWTN News In Depth. One increasingly common method of returning the focus to learning in our schools is banning the use of cell phones during the day. Some schools are also going almost completely tech-free and focusing on great books and classical education to teach the whole child, intellectually, socially, and morally. Classical education was discussed recently at a forum EWTN News attended in Washington, D.C.
Classical means that we have 2,500 years worth of experience thinking about what it means to be human, what it means to be virtuous, and how we might order our society toward the common good. And so we look back historically, largely so that we can be prepared to face our present moment.
Classical school education traditionally includes the study of Latin and Greek to reinforce the understanding of languages, liberal arts, classical literature, and history. It's often taught in charter schools, in faith-based schools, including some Catholic schools, and in home education. At that same conference, classical education proponent and educator Michael Ortner stressed the importance of getting students away from their cell phones.
These devices, these are, I view them as wonder-killing devices, if you will. So they're addictive, and I'd much rather see kids focus on their growth, the wider world around them, on learning, loving to read, falling in love with all of the subjects that they get in school, and focusing on that.
Ortner's Cana Academy provides online training for teachers as they strive to lead their students toward excellence. And his online Catholic school playbook is working to renew Catholic education and advance school choice. New research indicates parents are indeed seeking more educational options for their children. A recent Washington Post analysis of schooling in America shows homeschooling has become the fastest-growing form of education in America. That dramatic rise since the onset of the pandemic has largely sustained itself throughout this school year. The analysis estimates between 1.9 and 2.7 million homeschoolers in the U.S., compared to 1.7 million in Catholic schools and 3.7 in charter schools. Many of these students are benefiting from classical classical education methods. I'm joined now by two leaders in the classical education movement. Ian Rowe is the co-founder of Vertex Partnership Academies, where young students are taught the importance of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And Kimberly Begg, the editor of Catholic School Playbook at the Ortner Family Foundation. She's also the author of the new book, Unbreakable, Saints Who Inspired Saints to Moral Courage, which helps focus Catholic parents on life lessons for their children. Welcome, both of you, to the show. Kimberly, statistics now show that homeschoolers outnumber those in Catholic schools, but Catholic Schools Playbook is about reinvigorating that enrollment for Catholic schools. What are you all doing to make that possible?
Well, we're working with educators across the country. Catholic education is certainly still in a state of crisis. Right now, we have about 1.6 million students in about 6,000 Catholic schools. But that is a number that is decreased steadily every year. So in 2019, for example, we had about 1.7 million students in Catholic schools. But yes, you know, we are still seeing about 100 Catholic schools close a year, but we are also very much in a state of renewal. What's really exciting is we have this growing network of Catholic schools that are offering a faithfully Catholic education. So these are schools that are providing an authentic Catholic formation that have rediscovered the church's longstanding intellectual tradition and that are offering a curriculum and culture that are fully Catholic. And we are seeing schools make this move and rediscovering the church's longstanding education tradition. We are seeing joyful students and joyful teachers and families and a revival of schools and whole parish communities.
That's so beautiful.
Really an exciting time in Catholic education.
Absolutely. Well, education in general, lots of post-COVID opportunities. Ian, you are kind of Catholic adjacent. You're a proponent of tech-free education as well. Let's start with the first one, this Catholic adjacent piece with these beautiful pillars. Tell us a little more about Vertex and how it's related, at least physically, to the Catholic Church.
Yes, well, thank you for the opportunity. Well, we are in the Bronx, in a district in which, unfortunately, only 7% of kids who start ninth grade 4 years later graduate from high school ready for college, meaning that they start ninth grade and either drop out or 4 years later they do earn their high school diploma but still cannot do math nor reading without remediation if they were to go to college. So it's an area, like, unfortunately, much of the rest of the country, that are desperate for high quality options. And in locations like here in the Bronx, it used to be that robust Catholic schools were a great option for many families. This is a community that's predominantly Hispanic, Hispanic and Black, primarily low income. And so schools that were very values based were something very attractive and, frankly, an escape from the traditional school system. Over the years, as Kimberly just talked about, as there's been a decline in the number of Catholic schools, more values-based, now public charter schools have emerged. So we are tuition-free schools. In our case, we are organized around the four cardinal virtues, as you said, courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. It just so happens that when we were searching for real estate here in the Bronx, we discovered an old Catholic school that had been shut down in 2013, Blessed Sacrament. It's actually where Justice Sonia Sotomayor went to school, kindergarten through eighth grade, and she was the valedictorian. But it's been closed since 2013, so we are bringing it back to life by taking it over. So we are, as you say, Catholic adjacent.
Well, Kimberly, Michael Ortner, you know him well, mentioned the need for thinkers at work in comments at a recent conference. Let's listen to what he had to say.
There are lots of people who come into the workforce that are not good writers or who are not good public speakers or who don't think overly critically. And it's very hard for any company to teach that.
Now, he said that if they can think, companies can teach them the specific skills that they need. But what about those parents that are worried that their kids won't have the tech training they need to even be competitive when they're looking for a job?
Yeah, that's a great question, Monsi. You know, ironically, the schools that focus on cultivating very narrow skill sets, like being tech savvy, like coding, like schools that really focus very narrowly on STEM, actually do a less effective job in developing these skills in young people than schools that actually focus on educating the whole person. And there's a good reason for this. When you're educating the full person and you are immersing them in traditional disciplines like logic and classic literature and Latin and theology and philosophy, you are giving them the opportunity to make connections on their own, to have discussions in class, to be trying to figure out, you know, who they are in this world, and what their path is going to be in a way that is going to just open up their minds. And yes, you know, skills can be learned, like Mike said, on the job.
Well, Ian, your school model is also touted as mobile free. Will that be a hindrance in the workplace for minorities that you mentioned are a big part of the communities you serve?
Well, our schools are digital device free. I mean, our kids of all races are living at a time of constant distraction. If you look at, you know, if you observe the average teenager today, they're almost always their head is down, looking at a mobile device, even when they're with their friends. You know, they're bombarded with Facebook or Instagram or TikTok. And it's become a real problem. In fact, a number of attorneys generals are actually suing a lot of these tech companies for developing algorithms that become addictive. And it's led to all sorts of issues in terms of mental health crises, depression, alienation. So we actually made a decision that at our schools, at Vertex in the morning, every student has to, each one has a little pouch where they have to deliver their cell phone, their smartwatch, their AirPod, iPad, any
all
digital device has to be anything, everything, all the things. And it's locked into a pouch all day, and it's locked by the school, and it's not unlocked until the very end of the day. Frankly, I wish I could just keep it all day long so it wasn't in their lives at all. But we found that a digital device-free day has been extraordinary for our kids.
Kimberly, really quick, last question for you. We've run out of time, but your book, Falling During All the All Hallows Triduum for us Catholics, where we're focusing on the lives of the saints, give me the one thing that you hope that people will take away from that, especially parents, as they navigate schools and what the reality is now.
That it's really important to develop our children's moral imaginations and their Catholic imaginations. And there's no way around the cross. We're seeing a lot of families today trying to find a way around the cross for themselves and their children. And the best way to prepare our kids to go out in the world is by passing on one of the greatest traditions of the church, which is passing on the stories of the saints.
That's beautiful. We'll leave it right there. Thank you both. And I hope that you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
When we come back, a brief recap of the all-important Synod on Synodality. What comes next? And a look at religious events on All Souls Day.
It's a way of telling her that we're not forgetting her, that she's here with us and that she meant a lot for us.
We include a look at the Hispanic tradition of El Día de los Muertos, or the Day of the Dead, a tribute and prayers to our family long departed.
After weeks of dialogue, the Synod on Synodality ended last Sunday. Participants now return to their communities and prepare for the second assembly next year. In their final days, participants read and approved the synthesis document, a 42-page report that summarizes the Synod's discussions and provides guidance on next steps. The document does mention controversial issues like women's role in the church and recommends further study on a female diaconate. And though the report does not use the term LGBTQ persons, it emphasizes closeness with those who experience loneliness as a result of being faithful to the church's teaching on sexuality. Sheila Pyrus, Secretary of the Commission for Information of the Synod of Bishops, explains that the end of the assembly is only the beginning of deeper discernment.
We still have a whole 11 months to discern, to dialogue and to listen and to analyze this document that has come out of October 2023. So it's still an ongoing process. A lot more has to be done.
The second and final meeting of the Synod Assembly will take place in October of next year. The synthesis document calls for further study on multiple issues before the next assembly, but it does not specify who will carry this out. All 365 participants are invited back for the second round of discussions in 2024, but the document calls for the inclusion of more participants. And prior to that second assembly, another instrumentum laboris, or working document, will be drafted to guide discussions. On Monday, alleged victims of Father Marco Rupnik say Pope Francis's decision to lift the statute of limitations and open an investigation into the priest accused of sexual abuse is a step in the right direction. Rupnik, a famed artist, faces claims of sexual, spiritual, and psychological abuse that the Jesuits found to be highly credible. He was expelled from the Society of Jesus in June, and just last week, he was accepted into a diocese in his native Slovenia, in the Diocese of Koper, sparking outrage. Meanwhile, the Jesuits are now revealing they gave an exhaustive warning to the Bishop of Koper about the abuse allegations. Rupnik's work is prominently featured at our Shrine to Our Lady of Lourdes.
La pace sia con voi.
Pope Francis prayed for peace, hope, and mercy at a Mass to mark All Souls' Day on Thursday. At a Rome war cemetery amid scattered rain showers, he lamented the loss of the lives of all people in war, but especially the young. It has been a tradition for Francis to commemorate All Souls' Day in a cemetery, which he did from 2016 to 2021. Last year, he did not visit a cemetery, but offered Mass for deceased bishops and cardinals in St. Peter's Basilica, another papal custom. All Souls' Day has a special meaning for Hispanic Catholics who have a tradition of honoring the souls of their departed relatives during what's known as the Day of the Dead. Rizal Reyes explains its religious significance in this Catholic Life report.
The Dia de los Muertos, it is a spiritual day of recollection, a day of remembrance.
Every year on November 2nd, Catholics celebrate All Souls' Day. But in Mexico and other parts of Central America, it's widely known as Día de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead.
We can show the world what we do and how we celebrate it, with color, with dances, with food, with arts and crafts, with gathering together as a family.
In recent years, Day of the Dead has exploded in popularity. From Disney Pixar's 2017 animated film, Coco, to makeup tutorials online for extravagant looks. What started off as an ancient tradition celebrated by the Aztecs, fused with the teachings of the Catholic Church, is now a global holiday.
It's very connected to our indigenous ancestors and our Catholic faith without contradicting each other.
Ernesto Vega works at the Office of Religious Education for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. He explains that Day of the Dead has a rich meaning for Hispanic Catholics.
It's a spiritual celebration of remembering those who passed away. And for us Catholics, that remembrance is in connection with our faith because Christ is the one who invites us. And through his death and resurrection, we have the promise of our bodies being resurrected.
In many Hispanic homes, you will find an ofrenda.
Ofrendas, or altars, usually consist of pictures of departed loved ones, offerings such as their favorite food, flowers, candles, and other decorations.
And usually people think of the dead like a scary part, but it's part of our lives, and we like to remember it in a nice way. It's the only way to keep connected with your loved ones who are gone, in this case with my grandma.
Yerania Benicio is one of the coordinators for Dicolores Mexican Folk Dance Company. Born and raised in Mexico, Benicio wants to pass on the tradition she learned growing up onto the younger generation. She, along with the help of others, puts together a Day of the Dead exhibit in Gaithersburg, Maryland, every year. At home, Benicio has a special altar for her Mama Chayo.
Mama Chayo, she's the woman who raised us. She'll be happy about her snacks that we're offering her. And then we have some items there close to her, like these little items that were given by people who she loved. That's where we put them close by.
Altars have several levels representing the journey of the soul to reach its final resting place in communion with God. Some families include a crucifix and an image of Mexico's patron saint, the Virgin of Guadalupe.
And we believe that she is here, that her spirit is here with us. That she's watching of us, that she's taking care of us. Yeah, and prayers and all for her.
For Catholics, the main point of Day of the Dead is prayer, helping their departed loved ones reach their heavenly homeland. Like All Souls Day, during Day of the Dead, the faithful attend Mass and visit the cemetery, bringing flowers and food to adorn the graves. For Benicio's son, Diego, his favorite part of the day is
spending time with the family and making the altar, and it's just a welcoming door to them. But then we also go to church, and then we pray for them that they're having a good time in heaven.
Benicio hopes to keep the memory of Mama Chayo alive.
It makes us like reconnect with those feelings, those memories. I hope that this tradition doesn't fade, that it will continue with this. I'll try with my kids.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Headlines in the Weekend Review are next. Plus, we'll reveal the winner of that Notre Dame church property competition we told you about last week. We'll be right back. An interfaith vigil for the victims of the Maine shooting tops the Weekend Review. The vigil took place days after a gunman killed 18 people in Lewiston, Maine.
Michael Delorier II. Max Hathaway.
A bell rang out for each victim lost. Thousands gathered outside the Basilica of Saints Peter and Paul in Lewiston to listen, pray, and pay their respects. Though the shooting happened on Wednesday, the community was not able to hold the vigil until Sunday, after the shelter-in-place order was lifted. Father Daniel Greenleaf of the Basilica says that while it was fruitful to finally gather, he and the community are only just starting to heal and move forward.
Part of me still has the fear that it's going to happen again. I mean, that's what happens when people, you know, go through such a traumatic experience. I mean, you know, we as priests kind of live it closer. And I can't help but even during Mass kind of, it's like, look around, make sure, is there any noise? What's happening? And that, I think that's really what carries a heavier, a heavier burden.
Gunman Robert Card's body was found last Friday night. He died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Authorities are still piecing together how the Army reservist was able to carry out the shooting, despite his friends and family warning law enforcement months ago of his declining mental health and access to firearms. Voters in Ohio will cast their ballot next week on Issue 1, a measure that could enshrine abortion in the state's constitution. Eyes across the country are looking at Ohio's vote as a bellwether for similar ballot initiatives in other states next year. The state has already seen a surge of early voters and absentee ballots, and millions of dollars have been funneled into campaigns. Abortion supporters hope the amendment will return the protections of Roe v. Wade, but pro-life advocates worry that the amendment could do much more than Roe and remove essential safeguards for the procedure. If passed, Issue 1 would take effect 30 days after the November election. In Missouri, a similar abortion amendment could be on the ballot in 2024. This week, an appeals judge ruled against a Republican-written ballot that said the amendment would allow, quote, dangerous and unregulated abortions until live birth. The judge upheld language written by a lower court judge that he says are more impartial. The Secretary of State and Attorney General, both pro-life Republicans, plan to appeal the ruling. Nearly 100 people are dead or missing in Acapulco, Mexico, after a Category 5 hurricane slammed into the resort city last week. The storm, with 165-mile-an-hour winds, tore off roofs from homes, blew out glass windows, knocked down power lines, and flooded the city. The population of nearly 900,000 is struggling to find food and water. The Archbishop of Acapulco says it's time to find hope in Jesus.
May the Lord transform our death to life.
The Archbishop also thanked the Mexican Bishops' Conference for the campaign undertaken to help those afflicted by the storm. An estimated 10,000 homes were damaged, including several hotels. Residents have limited access to gas, power, and communications. The field of GOP presidential hopefuls is narrowing. Former Vice President Mike Pence became the first major candidate to leave the race for the White House. He dropped his bid last Saturday after struggling to raise money and gain traction in the polls. Pence says it was simply not his time.
So after much prayer and deliberation, I have decided to suspend my campaign for president effective today. Now, I'm leaving this campaign, but let me promise you, I will never leave the fight for conservative values, and I will never stop fighting to elect principled Republican leaders to every office in the land. So help me God.
The former vice president spoke with EWTN News this summer. He discussed with me the role his former Catholic faith played in his life growing up, his current reliance on his Christianity, and his hopes for the future of our nation. EWTN News will continue to bring you coverage of the 2024 presidential election, candidate interviews, debates, polling, and analysis from a Catholic perspective. And we have a winner. Last week, we told you about a University of Notre Dame competition sponsored by its Church Properties Initiative. Entrants from five continents submitted projects designed to creatively utilize vacant and underused church property for the common good. We invited one of the five finalists on our program last week to talk about the competition. We had no idea last week, but he was the winner. The Serenelli Project and its president and CEO, Marty Arlinghouse, took home the $10,000 first prize. The winning project, the prison ministry's planned purchase and renovation of an abandoned church in Cincinnati. It will become the parish home of returning citizens who are re-entering the community after serving their time behind bars. Congratulations to the Serenelli Project and all those other entrants who are creatively using old church property to better their communities. We'll be right back in a moment. The life of a monk at one of the oldest and most famous abbeys in the world. We travel to Austria when we return. We talked earlier in this program about classical education and the importance of learning how to read, write, and think deeply. That thoughtful and contemplative approach to living is very evident in an Austrian abbey with more than 900 years of monastic tradition. Reporter Colin Flynn takes us on a journey to Austria to look inside the walls of the famous Heiligenkreuz Abbey.
Nestled in the picturesque landscape of Austria, just outside Vienna, lies the enchanting Heiligenkreuz Abbey, with a long history of deep spirituality.
Well, this is the inner courtyard. These buildings go back to the year 1640.
Father Elred Maria is taking us on a tour of the Cistercian monastery, where the first thing you notice are the beautiful bells.
That's a carillon. So what the Germans call a glockenspiel.
This is a 3.5-octave carillon, so you're able to play different melodies. So when the people come here, they don't see this only as an historical monument. It should be a motivation for the prayer.
As you wander around the ancient monastery, you can't help but admire the beauty and the incredible craftsmanship.
We have this column in honor of the Blessed Trinity. The oldest part of this courtyard and of the monastery is this abbey church, which goes back to the 12th century. It was built in the Romanesque style, and one of its hallmarks is that it's very, very bare.
For the past 13 years, the abbot of the monastery has been the Reverend Maximilian Heim, who tells us a bit about the incredible and varied history of this spiritual place.
We have had ups and downs. In the beginning, there was certainly very rapid growth. Then, throughout history, there have been some big setbacks here, especially in 1683, when the Janissaries, the Turks, were on the outskirts of Vienna and, one could say, threatened the West. We actually experienced some tremendous destruction in the monastery. The monks fled in 1683, and thank God we were able to come back and rebuild the monastery. And in the 20th century, we were a smaller community, which then shrank again, especially after the Second World War, because quite a few confreres, especially those who were not priests, died in the war. The whole lay brotherhood at the abbey had come to an end.
But in the 1960s and 70s, much restoration work was carried out, and the monastery started to flourish again. Inside the church is where Father Elred Maria, along with his fellow Cistercian monks, celebrate Mass and sing the Divine Office daily.
And that's our workshop. That's where we sing the Divine Office. These are our big choir books. The greatest act of praise is the daily Mass, of course. Our Mass, our community Mass, which we call the conventual Mass, is celebrated at 6:30 in the morning at the high altar here. All the old Cistercian monasteries had the three great windows as a symbol of the Blessed Trinity.
While the interior of the church may be austere, the sacristy is anything but.
The great sacristy, which is built in the Rococo style.
Isn't it amazing that the style of the church is so minimalistic and bare,
that's
barren,
right, yes.
And then in here it is so rich and elaborate.
So elaborate, yes. It's meant to reflect in a very dim way the glory of heaven.
From the boiler to the water taps, beauty is everywhere. But despite the beauty, the reality of life in a monastery is not always easy.
Some people enter the monastery and think they've come to a paradise. Well, they very soon discover that they haven't.
It's hard work.
It's hard work, and people are very human. And you don't really leave the world behind you. You do in some ways, but you bring yourself with all your faults into the life.
But the light shines through, illuminating the lives of the monks within.
The stained glass windows are very, very old. And when we knew that the Ottomans were coming, the windows were removed and they were hidden in Vienna in a cellar for hundreds of years. Then they were brought back here in the 19th century,
I think. These very windows.
These very windows.
Isn't that incredible?
In another part of the monastery is the all-important chapter house.
This is where the life of every monk begins, because this is where on the 14th of August every year, the eve of Our Lady's Assumption, the novices are clothed in their habits and receive their new names.
Do you remember what it was like for you?
Well, it was rather nerve-wracking, actually. There, the sacred tetragrammaton, the unutterable name of the Almighty, in Hebrew letters.
Isn't it amazing, Father, that we're in the room where it all begins for you?
Yes.
And just next door is the room where...
where it all ends.
Where it all
That's
ends.
That's right, yes,
side
yes.
Side by side.
Yes, yes.
But right next door from where they enter the abbey is where they will eventually leave, the mortuary chapel.
When you die, your coffin is brought into this chapel for one day and one night, and every half hour during the day the monks pray here for the repose of your soul, and the holy sacrifice is offered at that altar.
It's situated right in the centre of the abbey, a constant reminder for the monks of their mortality, which is why their days of prayer and sacrifice are not dedicated to this life, but to the next life. As Austria becomes less and less religious, the members of this community are not fazed. They have survived through incredible moments of brutal history. And being so close to Vienna, Abbot Maximilian believes that the future survival of Heiligenkreuz Abbey will mean innovating while staying true to tradition.
Wir sind hier tatsächlich auch irgendwie eine Insel, möchte ich was sagen.
We are actually kind of an island here, a place that is a spiritual lighthouse shining into the big city. I think it's very important that people know that we are not cut off from the world, but we do not want to become secularized by the world. I believe that secularization is the biggest problem in the church today. We can be an oasis, a place where people can come and really draw from the deep sources of tradition here, but also the spiritual life that is very much alive.
And each day comes to an end here in the abbey with the abbot's final prayer, said in Latin.
May the Almighty Lord grant us a quiet night and a perfect end.
In Austria, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
And that does it for this week's program. I'm Montse Alvarado. We invite you to join us again next week at this time for a special edition of EWTN News in Depth dedicated to women religious. We'll take a look at some unique missions around the globe and the incredible work these sisters are doing to make our world a better place. We hope to see you then.